No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. And we're excited to have a special guest with us tonight. Maria, how are you?
Terrific.
Soon to be Dr. Maria.
As quickly as I can do my research and my writing and my chair and the reader turn it around. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes into it. But yes, it's very exciting. It's really exciting. It's almost pinched me. I can't believe I'm here. Exciting. But thank you for asking.
And before we bring on our exceptionally interesting guest, A. Scott Bolden, I just want to say that today I went and laid a wreath on the Georgetown waterfront to commemorate the 400 years of slavery in America. Maybe we can talk to Scott a little bit about that. Not 400 years of slavery, but 400 years ago, the first slaves were brought to a place called Port Comfort, Virginia in 1619. And we laid a wreath at a site in Georgetown, which is where the first slave ship, the Liverpool Merchant, docked in 1732 with 65 slaves on board. So we did that to commemorate a 400-year anniversary of the first slaves in America, and churches all across America rang their bells, and every national park in America participated. So it was a lovely ceremony, even though it was kind of a horrible chapter from world history that we commemorate.
Wondering, like, commemorate, it's kind of a word because it almost gives it honor, but it's not. Maybe an acknowledgement of...
The honor of it is that somehow these enslaved people overcame this horrible, horrible situation they were in, and they actually built Washington, D.C. They built the Capitol. They built the White House. They worked here in the district. So I think that's where the commemoration comes in, is the fact that we honor the memory of the sacrifices that they made to help lay the foundation for America and especially for our city. So although I agree, there may be a better word out there. I don't know what it is. But let's bring on our guest. A. Scott Bolden is an attorney in Washington, D.C., a prominent attorney. He's often heard on CNN, Fox, MSNBC, former chair of the D.C. Democratic Party, graduate of Morehouse College and Howard Law School. I could read you his bio, but that would take the entire show. He is really a seriously accomplished individual, and we're so happy to have him on the show. And before the show's over, I've got to ask him, because I read in his bio that he got the Good Scout Award, and I really want to know what that's about, because I'm a former Boy Scout. Scott, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me.
No, thanks
glad
for
be
being
here
on the show.
With you, Maria.
So yeah. What is the Good Scout Award?
Last year, as in every year, the Greater Washington Area Boy Scouts gives an Attorney of the Year Award at a luncheon And last year I was blessed enough to be their honoree. And it's a fundraiser, but it also recognizes a lawyer for his or her contributions to the community and for their attributes that are significant and consistent with the values and attributes of scouts, scout leaders, Boy Scouts, and Eagle Scouts. And so it was my privilege and honor to accept that award. And I try to live by those values daily, as I told them. My dad was a scout years ago, one of the few African-American-based scout troops in Chicago area years ago in the 40s and 50s. And he was homeless for several years and really had a tough childhood. And the scouts really saved him. He went on to be one of the first African-American graduates of the University of Illinois Law School and the University of Illinois. And in my conversations with him about accepting the award, I was never a Boy Scout, but he told me for the first time his story of triumph vis-a-vis becoming a foster child, leaving a homeless life with his brothers and sisters, and that scouting and the oratory contest and a lot of individuals in Joliet, Illinois, helped him when he needed it most. And it changed his life. He became a lawyer, a treasury agent, head of the NAACP, and is now a retired judge in Will County. And really my hero and why I became a lawyer. I grew up watching him try cases all over the state of Illinois, sometimes in southern Illinois, which is below the Mason-Dixon line, when he and I were the only people of color in the courtroom. But at 8 years old, watching him try a case, as well as staying with what he would say, quote, relatives, but I had never met them before because there was nowhere for black people to stay. And this was before, and even after, rather, the Public Accommodations Act and Civil Rights Act that were passed in 65. And so that connection to the scouts, my dad, and my 32-year career as a lawyer all came together at that luncheon with that award. And it was just really a wonderful experience and a wonderful organization that I'm still involved with, and I encourage all of my other colleagues to stay involved with.
Wow, what a story.
Unbelievably inspirational. Yeah. My goodness.
Yes. Your dad's now my new hero. What an amazing, what an amazing guy you must be, Scott. And I'm a former scout. I came out of Newark, New Jersey, which was not a nice place to grow up as a child, and I have much of the same feelings about scouting. I got to talk. I got to give a speech with Eleanor Holmes Norton in front of the oldest scout troop in America, the first scout troop, which was started by Woodrow Wilson, and I consider it a great honor, too.
I still talk to my dad every day. He's still my best legal advisor, and he's retired now. He's in his mid-80s, and still sharp as a whip, as I say.
Woo! Wow.
That's great.
And
he must be so proud of you, too.
Legally.
Yes, he must be.
And how do you manage to be on CNN and Fox and MSNBC and the Fox Business Network?
Yeah, we got a bad connection. I can't hear you.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me, Scott? Scott, can we hear you?
Hello?
Hello, can you hear us? Hey,
hello?
Doug, you may want to try to get him back. Yeah, let's try to get him back on. We'll try in a second. I'm sorry about the bad connection.
Yeah, because I can hear you fine, Michael. Yeah, and I could hear him too.
Yeah, it must be we've got him on a cell phone.
I was just curious about how he's able to straddle both worlds of CNN and Fox and MSNBC and Fox Business Network. That's quite the accomplishment.
Yeah, it is quite the accomplishment. And he's a great speaker. And, you know, and I think that's what attracts all those people to him, is that rather than giving you the partisan line, he's given you, you know, really what he feels about things. He's very honest, straightforward. So,
and interestingly,
are you back with us, Scott?
I'm back with you. I don't know where you were under mine.
Sorry about that. You sound great. Okay. Hey, let me ask you, because you know so much about the Democratic Party and you were a former leader of the Democratic Party here in D.C., I'm scared as a Democrat because I don't think the Democrats are getting it. I think that they think that the objective is to go after Donald Trump, President Trump, but they're ignoring the millions of people that stand behind this man who now has only a 36% approval rating, but he won with a 40% approval rating. So how do you feel about that? Do you think we're not getting it, that we're not addressing the issues that America really cares about?
I think you're right, but I think the Democrats are right to make it about beating Trump. I'm not sure they need to be making it about Trump. That's the first thing. Secondly, from an organizational standpoint, we've got about 20 candidates. I was just on with MSNBC this morning on with David Gura, and John Delaney from neighboring Maryland was there and said he was in it for the long haul. And he's free to stay in it for the long haul, but we got to get down to business. And we got to get down to business with a few candidates. We need a nominee. And then to put all our time, money, and resources into defeating Trump, not just for the country, but for the world, as you see from the G7. If I was a Democrat, I'd be scared, but I'd be cautiously optimistic that we can do this. You know, the DNC just voted against moving climate change up on the debate agenda for the debates coming up, which I think was a real mistake. But the reality is that we've got to make this a value decision by Democratic voters and American voters in 2020. That is, we got a lot of policies. We disagree with the Republicans on almost every policy, and that's true. At the same time, though, the heart and soul of America is at stake. Are we the party and the country of Donald Trump and all of his nonsense across the board? Or are we that shining house on the hill? Are we the party or are we the country of Kennedy and others? And I think America, no matter whether you've been left behind on the economic uplift or whether you are without a job, whether you're without health care, voters have to make a value decision given the last 2.5 years, 3 years of Donald Trump and the GOP, including those like Mitch McConnell and other GOP leadership on the House and Senate side that have been enabling Donald Trump and his divisive and racist policies. We've got to go after them, too, because as Martin Luther King said, we may forget about our enemies, but we shall never forget about the silence of our friends while this has occurred. And there are a lot of people who have assisted Donald Trump in his divisiveness and his xenophobia and his racism. And that's really what's on the ballot in 2020.
The problem is that the primary season is so long, it gives so many of the contenders the opportunity to give black eyes and to denigrate and to put holes into whatever it is that they're standing for. And then when there's the last person standing, they got to lick those wounds and get together and unify.
Yeah, that's always a problem. You know, the Republicans bloodied up Donald Trump quite a bit and in 2016, and he wound up winning. The Democrats have to put a candidate forward. Our former candidate in 2016, Hillary Clinton, God bless her, love her to death. I've been a longtime supporter of the Clintons, and they've been a supporter of mine. But she certainly was not the very best candidate against Donald Trump. And there were a lot of independents and moderate Republicans who took a chance. A lot of Democrats stayed home. And we need the Democratic base, black people, brown people, independents, educated, as well as white working class voters who are in the Democratic Party or were part of the Democratic Party before they voted for Donald Trump, to get out and vote Democratic as a valued position, as a valued vote, that we stand for justice and equality and freedom for all, and we don't stand for this divisiveness that we've been experiencing. You know, we told the Republicans and independents 4 years ago, we told them in 2016 what the leadership or presidential would be, what President Trump would be like. And he's kept every promise we've made to America as to a reason not to vote for Donald Trump. So the only thing that's really changed is now we've lived it, and now you see all of us ought to be really, really motivated, those who love America with its imperfect self, to get out and vote Democratic. But the Democrats got to put up a viable candidate who not only speaks to the issues, but speaks to the values of America, the very best of values. And if we do that, I think we can win this thing, but we have to be laser-like focused, and we got to get to a single candidate, a single nominee, sooner than later. And that's the part that disturbs me. We got a lot of great candidates. They could all beat Donald Trump, but we need a unified message, including whether to impeach Donald Trump or not. And so we need to get more organized, more focused, and we need to move forward in a workmanlike manner to get this done, because the future of America depends on it.
And how do you feel about impeachment? You know, I happen to agree with Nancy Pelosi's longstanding position that we shouldn't impeach him, because we know that the House, brings the indictment and prosecutes, but the Senate convicts, and the Senate's not going to convict him. So do you think we should go through the exercise?
I certainly think we have a constitutional obligation to go through that exercise. The House can't worry about what's going to happen on the Senate side. The House has a constitutional duty to do this, whether it's because he has ignored subpoenas, he's directed others to ignore subpoenas for the House to do their jobs and the committee investigations, whether it's his racist comments, whether it's what he's done with funds at the border, whether it's got to do with his immigration and his divisive policies. There's a laundry list of reasons why he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, including violating the Emoluments Clause, including owning his various companies, and setting forth policies such as his tax policies, whereby his personal business interests would be benefited. You've got to do your job. And if you play politics with this political process, that is, well, he's not going to be thrown out of the White House because of the Senate. It does not matter. What matters is the Constitution and doing what's right during these times of difficulty that the president and the GOP has put all of us, the danger and the risk has put all of us in, both economically and socially and politically and racially. It's got to be done. And so we disagree. I understand and appreciate you and Nancy Pelosi's position, but we've got to get a unified front on this. This is not going to be easy. It's not about our plans. It's about a value decision and whether we want someone like the GOP and Donald Trump in the White House and as elected officials moving this party, moving this country in a very divisive way. It's got to stop, and the power of the ballot box is our greatest weapon, but the House has another weapon, and that's impeachment, and we've got to get behind that. Otherwise, like you, you're concerned, but other Democrats, as I talk and travel the country, they're confused about why we don't impeach or why there's this public debate whether to impeach or not. From their viewpoint, Democrats on the ground, it's an easy call, and we've got to act on that calling.
Because I think strategically, I appreciate what you're saying morally and ethically and with values, it should proceed. But strategically, I'm afraid it would provide a distraction, and it would also galvanize whomever is for Trump or on the fence about him to rush to his defense.
But look at the risks associated with that, though, on the other side. This is what Donald Trump will say. Given the Mueller report and whatever spin he puts on it, Donald Trump going into the campaign will make the argument, I guarantee you, that he was absolved of any wrongdoing by the Mueller report. And regardless of what the Dems think about him, they never attempted to impeach him. They never indicted him or impeached him in the House. So as a result, the Democrats and the Republicans, he would argue, have totally vindicated him. And he's got a big megaphone and a big base to do that. And he's got more money than the Democrats have to rebut that. That's a very dangerous position that we're giving away to the Republicans and to the president by not impeaching him.
Well, that's a good point. And I know that we have to bring people together and get them to the polls. And we had a problem with this last time with Hillary Clinton. I was a Hillary Clinton superdelegate. And we had a problem with middle-class white women. We had a problem with African-Americans. What do we need to do, for example, with African-Americans to get them back in the fold? Or has Donald Trump done enough for us already with his racist tweets? Do you think the African-American community is motivated and they'll be out there to vote for the Democratic candidate? Or does it depend on the candidate?
Well, you can never take the black vote for granted. That's the first thing. Second of all, the Democratic Party and Tom Perez and the Democratic nominee have to remember who they are as the Democratic Party and the importance of the black vote, especially the black women vote. You saw what happened in the Senate race with Jones down in Alabama. You saw in the moderate districts in the midterms whereby the Democrats won several seats to take over control of the House. But more importantly, there's a statistic I want to share with you all and your listeners, and that is this. The Democratic Party has not won the majority white vote in any presidential election since Lyndon Baines Johnson. Every Democratic president that's won since Johnson has won with an outpouring of black support, brown support, and others who don't look like me. And so if you're going to go to your base, you've got to get the black vote out to win. Clinton won it by getting the black vote out and the Latino vote out. Barack Obama won by getting massive voter turnout in those urban communities. And while the white working class is important, they left the Democratic Party a long time ago. And so if you're going to win this thing against Trump with his divisiveness and with this 40% baked in, then you're going to have to get out and have a massive voter turnout in those urban communities. You just have to, because that's how you're going to win. And if you look at the voting numbers in 2016, when Hillary Clinton was the nominee, the voter turnout for black people and brown people was 10 to 15% down in areas of the country like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, down 10 to 15% that made the difference. Think about it. Those three states had a ton of delegates, and the Democrats only lost by a total of 66,000 votes. Nothing's changed between 2016 and now, other than that we've lived under Donald Trump's what appears to be what he would call leadership and I would call nonsense. We got to go get those black and brown voters out in order to win this thing, and we can take nothing for granted if we can appeal to the farmers and to the white working class and rural America about what promises Donald Trump made and what Donald Trump, how he hasn't kept those promises. That's fine, but your base and your pathway to winning this Democratic presidency in 2020 is through the black and brown vote. Statistically, there's no debate about it.
Well, and you know, as someone who was a consultant to the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign, I know that this being taken for granted, black people inside the Democratic Party have had this problem for years of feeling that the black vote was taken for granted by the Democrats,
that they would vote Democratic without spending a lot of money in those communities. If they presumed it, so why go and spend a bunch of money in those communities? You've got to invest in those communities. You can't be afraid to talk to black and brown people about issues that are important to them, especially reforming criminal justice, police brutality, gun control. You name it, health care, equal education, all of these issues that the Republican Party stand against and that the Democratic Party stands for. You've got to be talking about those issues, and you got to be talking about the race question. America's promise versus what she really is, with her tortured past, with racism and slavery and Jim Crow and segregation, and how people of color in total have been treated. We got to talk about that. And ironically, Donald Trump is creating a platform to do just that. The 1619 Project with the New York Times is telling real stories and doing real analysis on the brutality of slavery, on the brutality of not even being able to trace your ancestry, because my ancestors were treated as chattel. And so you can only go back so far before you can even build the ancestry of African-Americans in this country. And so maybe this is the time to have that debate, but we need our base to come out, and that's black people and brown people voting in large numbers to win. And then they need to vote in large numbers on the Senate side. There are 12 seats up. Several of them were in states where Hillary Clinton won. We're going to have our challenge in Kentucky, but we got to win the Senate back as well. It's not a 1-4 or 2-4. We got to do both in order to get Democratic control and move this country forward.
But interestingly, the latest Fox poll, which is about a week old, was polling black Democrats, and they say of likely voters, Biden is 37%, and the last three CNN polls have Biden at 44% among black voters. So it looks like it's a good guess, bet, odd, but I hear what you're saying about don't take it for granted.
You got to go get them.
Because, of course, anyone can change their mind. Right. And let them know that they're valued and that they're understood and that they've been heard.
Exactly. And you've got to go get them. A vote's not a vote until it's cast.
Right.
It's not a vote until it's cast. And those of us in politics and those of us been involved in Democratic politics, both at the national level and the local level, you've got to get them to the polls. You've got to count those votes. And we've got to fight voter suppression all around this country that is still real. Listen, the Republicans do voter suppression. They do voter fraud. They close polling places. They bar registration. They have in Texas and North Carolina and South Carolina and even in the far West, they still have voter suppression, legalized voter suppression on the books in regard to voter rolls being reduced in Georgia and other places. We've got to fight that, too. This vote is under attack. The Republicans don't want us to vote because they know when we vote, Democrats win. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. They want as few of us, Democrats and black and brown voters, to vote because they know when we come out and win, when we believe that we've connected with the Democratic nominee, when we believe the Democratic nominee is going to make life better for all of us on employment, on justice issues, on police issues, on health care and education, those are our core issues in our communities, then we win. And then the Democrats, whoever that nominee is, whoever the next Democratic president is, he's got to deliver. He or she has got to deliver on those promises to our urban communities and our communities that have come out and put Democrats in control. It's a long process, but there's a 3 or 4 step process to turning America around. We're up for it. We can do it. But we've just got to implement that plan.
Well, you know, Scott, I've got to tell you that you're one of the first people I've heard talk like this. And for a very long time, this has been a problem for me, exactly what you're talking about. I think as Democrats far too often, and I think we saw this with the Hillary Clinton campaign, we talk down to America. You know, we say, you know, I think that was a problem with the Clinton campaign. She went to Utah, but she didn't go to Wisconsin. You know, we take it for granted that you know, that we know what we're doing. You know, you don't want a gun. You're just too dumb to realize it. Let us explain it to you. And I think
I'm not going to take your guns from you.
Yeah, or I'm not going to take your guns from you.
Even gun control.
Right. Right. Maria, you know, I grew up around guns. Maria was an NRA member as a child. You know, I don't want to take your guns. I just want to keep them out of the hands of crazy people. So how do we change the narrative in the Democratic Party? Any ideas on that? What do we do? What do we say to our candidates to say, you got to be real. You got to go out and do exactly what you're saying?
Well, it's messaging one. It's money to get that message out. I got no problem with people being a member of the NRA. I got no problem with people who want to own guns. I got a problem with not having background checks. I got a problem with not having a policy or legislation passed on banning weapons of mass destruction, AK-47s, AK-15s. Yeah, assault weapons, a ban on assault weapons, which we know doesn't stop crime or shootings, but it reduces the carnage. We know from 1994 to 2004, we saw a significant reduction. This is just good common sense gun control. And you can be both. You can be pro-gun, and you can be pro-gun control. And if you've got an AK-47 or 15 or any other weapon of mass destruction, then you can own that. But why do you have to own it and stockpile it in your home? You can keep it at your gun range if that's the only thing you're using. And we've got to enforce these red flag laws where we're taking guns from the mentally ill or those on borderline mentally ill and not be afraid to implement that. And we've got to put more money in human services for in public dollars to treat mental illness, to treat teenagers and young men who are feeling lonely and are feeling lost and see a gun and mass shootings as a way out or way to implement or manifest their hate that they're feeling, including them choosing white nationalism, the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party, these hate groups, as well as street gangs. I don't understand why a First Amendment gives them protection when both of those groups are associated with violence. We can inhibit and restrict their First Amendment if they're going to commit violence under the First Amendment protection. We got that position of mine is not very popular, but you don't have a right to kill people. Free speech ain't never been free speech for those who take guns and shoot hundreds of people or tens of mass murderers, if you will. You shouldn't have a right to have that assault weapon when you're going to do that damage. And people kill people, I know, but people with guns kill people. So anything that's going to help reduce that carnage, anything that's going to help stop the killing, even if it's a possibility, we ought to treat it as a probability and pass legislation that closes the gun loopholes. We ought to have mental health wait periods. We ought to have gun registration and background check wait periods. And we ought to close the loophole for people who buy guns at gun shows. I don't mind access to guns, but let's be reasonable about it.
Well, you know, and the sad thing about these things that you're saying, Scott, is that most of the American people agree with them.
Could argue with you? What's to argue?
Most Americans believe in background checks, and they believe in most of the things that you've talked about, and yet the NRA has been able to keep us from getting there.
I mean, and the NRA is in disarray, and they still yield a lot of power.
Yeah,
but almost everything we do requires some kind of cursory background, employment, licensure, being with around children, clergy,
exactly.
Thumbprints, live scan. We need to know who's going to be consorting with these folks. Why would it be any different with a lethal weapon?
Well, I think it starts with leadership. If you look at the manifestos of white nationalists, if you look at the manifesto of the shooter in El Paso, and you compare it to the rhetoric from the president about immigrants and immigration and the Browning of America and the anti-immigrant sentiment because of the Browning of America, they match up word for word very often. And so you have the racists out here, like white nationalists, who believe and support Donald Trump. And so the racists believe that he's a racist, and he does nothing to dissuade them from supporting him. This is dangerous stuff. People are dying, and more people are going to die if we don't do something about it. And if we don't do something about it as our elected officials in the House and Senate and the White House, then we are just as culpable. They are just as culpable. They're worse than the shooter because they had an opportunity to stop future shootings and to stop future killings and did nothing about it. And right now, they're doing nothing about it.
Yeah, and yeah, it really is terrible. And, you know, on the internet, you can find somebody that agrees with you about, you know, anything. And I think most people don't look for the truth. I think they look for evidence that supports their prejudices. So they go on the internet and, you know, and they find kindred spirits. And when they're mentally incapacitated or they have mental problems, that's really all they need. Hey, can
or
we
they just
gears?
Believe in a racist ideology. We got to do something to stop that. We've got to do something about this race question, man. We really do. We, you know, listen, we're all Americans. I love this country as much as anybody else that doesn't look like me. And yet and still, we still have not resolved the race question. We've never reconciled our racial history, and we continue to live through this. All that's going on now in America is just a manifestation of not having reconciled this question of race. White America wants to move on and cite Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey and say all has been, we have paid our debt of our original sin. People of color, at least black people, in my opinion, we don't want to talk about it. We're embarrassed by it. We just want to matriculate and integrate and have a fair share and a fair opportunity. But it's not going away. It's not working for us. Whether you put it in the terms of slave reparations, if you put it in terms of America's apology that is necessary and required to African Americans and our ancestors, we have got to reconcile this question. And it's going to take a national dialogue and something of significant import to get all of us comfortable not only talking about race, but the race question, our racial history, and what it means. Because otherwise, we're going to continue to be very divided. You'll have people of success who are people of color and who have lived the American dream, but they shouldn't be the exception. All of us who are living in poor and the least and the lost and the left out, as Marion Barry used to say, they need a fair opportunity and a fair shot. And their racial history and their mistreatment by the system and by individuals, whether it's physical violence or whether it's being denied jobs or whether it's mass incarceration and the prison complex, these are all bad. These are all images, if you were, or passages of slavery and the lack of race reconciliation in this country. I don't think we can avoid it any longer. I really don't. And whoever the next president is has got to address it. And during this campaign, we need to address it.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that you're preaching to the choir here. We had Marianne Williamson on the show who talked about reparations. Last week we had Duke Professor William Darity, who's like the leading expert on reparations.
Yeah, you're going out again.
We need to have the conversation. I agree 100%. And we need to be able to connect the dots. You know, I said today in my speech before the people on the Georgetown waterfront, there's a connection between bringing enslaved people here in boats against their will and locking children in cages at the border. Brown children in cages at the border. So I think you're right. We absolutely have to do that.
Very much so. And I said vestiges earlier. I meant vestiges of slavery. These are manifestations of vestiges of slavery. But it's got to be addressed. And not just by black and brown people, by the way.
Right.
We need
absolutely.
White America to step in and lead on this. The civil rights movement wasn't successful because black and brown people had enough. The civil rights movement was successful because it took all of us, black, white, brown, and yellow.
That's
it took
right.
all religions, our Jewish brothers and sisters who are often under attack. It took the Catholic Church and the letter from Birmingham to the religious leaders from Martin Luther King. It took all religions and all creed and colors to stand up and say that this was wrong, how we were treating black people in this country. And so to get past this segment of our history and to really put the question of race and racial history to bed and to reconcile and resolve it, it's going to take all of us. It's just not a black problem. It's an American problem.
Exactly. And that's what I keep thinking, is it concerns us as Americans, regardless of what race we may represent. And if we can have that conversation and have some healing and have some agreement, then perhaps you're right, we could move on, and this would no longer be a conversation that we need to have.
Yep, yep.
And I'm not saying sweep it under the rug, you know, let's just forget that it ever happened. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about informed consent and people coming forward, and sometimes the truth is ugly and it hurts, but we need to make peace with it.
Exactly. And you'll gradually see the change in America. I'm convinced of it. It's not about blaming white America and their ancestors. It's not about blaming black people for where they are right now in the socioeconomic and health numbers. It is about reconciliation. It's about understanding, appreciation. But the one thing that we cannot tolerate is violence against people of color. We cannot tolerate police brutality. We cannot tolerate the Nazi Party and white nationalism and the Ku Klux Klan and what they stand for. All of us, black, white, yellow, and brown, have got to stand up against that and say, this is not our America. America's promise of the American dream has got to be real for all of us. And the American dream not reached, and it's a flawed dream if we don't reconcile who America is and has been compared to what America's promise is. They've got to meld into one. And for 400 years, it hasn't. It hasn't. We've done a lot of different things. We've done a lot of damage to it. But, you know, even with the civil rights movement, we haven't made peace with it and reconciled our differences to move America forward. And don't you dare blame Donald Trump solely for this. This has been a systematic racism that we have lived with in this country for hundreds of years, and it's got to stop. Nobody's born a racist in this country. There's no racist gene in white people, black people, and brown people, all right? Racism is made. It is taught. Mm-hmm. You're not mm-hmm. born. You're not born a racist. You're mm-hmm. made a racist, right?
Yep.
It's got to
yes.
stop. And it's got
well,
to stop
it's
now.
Always amazed me our capacity as human beings to compartmentalize. You know, I am a big fan of Thomas Jefferson. I think he was the most eloquent writer of about democracy and freedom, yet he was a slave owner.
Exactly.
All the founding fathers were slave owners. So,
and you know
we just have this ability to talk one way and act another. Can I ask you something? I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time here, Maria.
Okay.
I want to ask you real quickly, since you've been so involved in D.C. politics, why do we have this problem, in your opinion, of so much corruption in our political system in the District of Columbia? You know, since I've been elected, I've seen Harry Thomas and Michael Brown go to jail, Kwame Brown resign. Now we're talking about Jack Evans and some of the things he's done. What can we do about this locally? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think that it starts with the individuals and what are their values. Their values when they got elected and their values when they have been elected for 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, 16 years. Something happens to our elected officials. You know, Marion Barry once told me, he's a former client of mine, and I represent his estate right now. Marion Barry said to me often, you know, you can't get rich being a public official, being an elected official. And those right. who try to get rich in public office get indicted, you know. And Marion
right.
never was indicted or charged or tried for taking money or for corruption of any kind. And I often asked him, why? He was in office as long as anyone else. And he told me, he said, it's just never been in my heart. I've always been about the people. And sure, I was flawed. I had my issues with alcohol and drugs and other personal issues. But my political commitment to the District of Columbia and to the people never waned. And that's why he's still loved by all in D.C. and elsewhere, by black, brown, and white people who voted him in a third time or more. He was always committed, and he never lost sight of that. I think some of our elected officials, after being called honorable and being introduced and passing legislation and helping those who need it the most. I think they swerve. They throw a curveball at us, and then their values get either manipulated or their value system gets confusing to them, and then they start to take liberties with the values and their duties as public elected officials and who their commitment is. I mean, that's kind of my take on it. I've represented a lot of politicians, both nationally and locally. And I must tell you, you've got to fight, you got to stay humble, and you got to fight that change that comes with power, because power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. And we've lived the manifestations of this over the last, I'd say, 5 or 10 years. But the system itself, there's some things you could do. You could reduce the amount of contributions, the level of contributions. You could also reduce how you bundle locally and what have you. But look at this. 10 years ago or so, the council, the people of D.C. voted to reduce the amount of contributions we could make to elected officials. And look what happened. The council overturned it. Now, if you're going to fight for voting rights, and you're going to fight for one vote, one person, and equal representation in the House, and for self-control of your finances, and you want to vote for statehood, then we ought to be the biggest advocates for people when they pass when they pass petitions for certain laws. And when the council usurps it, usurps the vote of the people, the petition of the people, then it's kind of hard to take them seriously as a body, as a political body, because then they appear to be hypocritical, they appear to lack credibility, and, you know, we got to be one or the other. We got to either fight for statehood and respect the vote of the people when they pass these petitions, or otherwise, you know, we appear to be hypocritical, and that makes our job tougher to get statehood and a vote in Congress. That's just my personal view.
Well, that's absolutely the truth. And we don't even have to go back that far. We saw them overturn Initiative 77 recently, which was overwhelmingly passed by the voters.
Exactly.
And it was something that I was against. But once it got passed, I fought like hell with other people like Reverend Hagler to get them to say, hey, look, this is what the voters decided. You can't usurp their opinion. You know, how can you go to Congress and say you can't tell us what to do and then turn around? You can't ignore us and then turn around and ignore your own voters. Yeah, I just thought it was crazy.
You can't have it both ways. And it may be tough, but you can't have it both ways.
Scott, I'm real curious if you've ever considered running for office.
Oh, he says.
Oh, yes. I've run in 2006. But I was too honest. My personality probably had more to do with it than me being too honest. But, you know, I ran in 2006. I think we ran a great campaign. The votes weren't there. And as I say, the people of the District of Columbia wanted me to go back to practicing law more than they wanted me to be their elected official.
Well,
and I accepted their vote.
One resident of the District of Columbia that would love to see somebody like you on the council, Scott. I really would. Part of my opinion about all this is that the people of power in the District of Columbia, the people that have money and live in wards 2, 3, 4, and 6. Can tell you more about Hillary Clinton than they can about Muriel Bowser. They focus on national politics, and I think a lot of these guys get away with stuff because we don't keep an eye on them. You know, but that's my personal opinion. I would love to see
you're breaking up
Scott, Council Member A. Scott Bolden. Did we lose him again?
I think so. Shucks.
Shucks.
I didn't realize that he had run because he's so passionate. He's so articulate. He's so knowledgeable. He's so learned. And he knows all the players I was thinking, man, what a great candidate.
Yeah, he was a great candidate. Doug, can we try to get him back? And yes, he ran against the same guy I ran against, Maria.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm back.
Okay, good.
Well, thanks, Scott. And what Maria and I were just saying, Maria was just saying about your passion and how articulate and passionate you
and
are.
And wise.
Yeah, that we really could use a guy like you on the council, although you would have to take a serious cut in salary.
Yeah, I was about to say, I can't afford it now, guys.
Yeah. Well, I know. I read, although I find this so hard to believe because you're still so young and handsome and charming, I read that you're a grandfather.
I am. And flattery will get you everywhere. But
I know. That's why I do it.
I got a 14-year-old granddaughter who's in Atlanta.
Wow.
She visits me often in D.C. And, you know, good. I'm back managing the D.C. office of Reed Smith. And I'd like to say or think that I'm having impact in other ways than being on the council or any other elected office. And I'm happy with that. I'm comfortable with that. And my part of my resistance is my legal and political commentary on CNN, on MSNBC, and even on Fox. I think it's important that Democrats go to the belly of the beast and send our message. We're not going to convince many the Trump voters or those on Fox News who have their own shows or anchors or moderators, but the message still needs to be heard. And I must tell you, when I travel around the country, Republicans come up to me in the airport. They come up to me at dinner, if you will. We have great conversations. They're not all happy with Trump. But as you said earlier, they kind of compartmentalize because they like the tax cut or they like the low unemployment rate or they like his position on China. And I often tell them, that's great. I'm a business Democrat. And so I've benefited from some of those policies. But those policies are to the detriment of America. We're going to raise the deficit by $4 trillion already, and we're only 2.5 years into the Trump administration. What happened to the conservative view of finances? This is hurting us long-term and short-term. And so it's a real problem. And again, I keep going back to the Democrats being focused on this, because Donald Trump and the GOP leadership is really dangerous right now. It's not about politics. It's about being the best of America, and we're just not there yet.
Well, Scott, we're running out of time here, so I want to give you an opportunity. Is there anything you want to add, something that we haven't asked you or something you'd like to say before we sign off?
You've given me plenty of opportunity to kind of share my best thoughts with your listeners and with you all. You all have been great. I didn't know about this podcast, but I think it is so timely and appropriate. And both of you all are doing an awesome job. Love to come back anytime. And I think the dialogue about the district and it being not a state and not having a vote in Congress is so important. It's another injustice in this country. And the Democrats pay lip service to it. It's on their Democratic plank. But even when the Democrats controlled all three houses, we still didn't make much progress. Made some, but not much progress. At least with the Republicans, they tell you they're not for it. But I think there's going to be some movement in the future. I think the Maryland delegation and Virginia delegation, I think we're seeing some movement there. And I hope that if the Democrats are in control in 2020, or rather 2021, that they can correct this injustice, not just on the race question, but on our independence in the District of Columbia. It's necessary, it's appropriate, it's right, it's fair, it's justice, and it's long overdue.
Well, I couldn't say it better. And just so our listeners know, you're right, Scott, there's been movement. We're going to have the first hearing on a statehood bill that's been before Congress in 25 years. We're going to have our first hearing on the bill on September 19th, we have 218 co-sponsors in the House. That's enough to pass the bill. So there is movement. Unfortunately, you're also right about the Democrats. We only have 33 of them in the Senate who sponsor the bill. So we still have work to do. But you're right, there is movement. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I want you to do me a personal favor next time you talk to your father. Please tell him he's got yet another fan in Washington, D.C. He sounds like you. Just an amazing, amazing human being. And I guess that shouldn't surprise me because, you know, the old adage is the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so Scott, thanks again, Scott.
We should give a shout out to your ascottbolden.com website for people to learn more about you and contact you as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm on Twitter, ASB the Law. I'm on Facebook. You can certainly find me there at ASB the Law, and ASB.com is the website. And, you know, I enjoy doing the media stuff, but I started doing it once Trump got elected, because it's going to take each of us to stand up, to be the face and the heart and the soul of the resistance. And that's a good thing, whether you're on the far left of the Democratic Party, whether you're a moderate. I think more moderates need to, on the Republican side and Democratic side, need to be elected so we can get something done. May not get it all done in one fell swoop, but I think we need to get on the same page, and that's one way of doing it. I love my far left. I certainly support them without a doubt, but we need a good mix of moderates and those on the far left. Because we all love this country, and we all want to make this country a better place for all of us. It's not over yet. Keep up the fight.
All right. Thank you, Scott Bolden. We hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great week. Yes. And good luck. Happy end of summer. It's Labor Day next weekend.
That's right.
And for our listeners on Labor Day, we'll be running a rerun because I'll be in India speaking at a conference, and hopefully when I get back from India, we'll be able to talk about that a little bit. Meanwhile, Maria will be continuing her pursuit of academic excellence, and I hope having time on Labor Day weekend to go to a barbecue or something. We're going to leave you today with a song by Warren Zevon in honor of our guest. Maria, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Safe travels, and thank you, America, for making us a part of your lives. We appreciate the loyalty.
Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote.